The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society. The Korea Society, in 2007, celebrating 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. The North Korean nuclear crisis has been defying resolution for years. However, the recent midterm elections in the U.S. and changes on the Korean Peninsula may finally break the impasse. What steps will it take to make progress at the renewed six-party talks? And what will a solution mean for the future of North Korea and the U.S. role in Northeast Asia? On November 21st, the Korea Society convened a panel of experts to address these questions. In part two of our five-part series, Leon Siegel, director of the Northeast Asia Cooperative Security Project at the Social Science Research Council in New York, spoke about the reasons behind the long diplomatic stalemate.
Good. Richard Rappaport is here from the Asia Society. And?
Henry Langert.
Good. We are co-sponsors of this group. I think we first received a call from the Asia Society saying, what are you going to do about the what's happened in North Korea? And that sort of galvanized us. And so we're very happy to work together with you. And forgive me for not mentioning it earlier, but I looked in vain for somebody to name. So I'm glad you're both here in the front line. And thanks very much for working with us on this program. All right, next is Lee Siegel. Lee?
Thanks, Don. I have a favorite conservative philosopher, which I know will amuse some people who know me and don't think of me as having conservative philosophers in my... it's George Santayana, and he once said, fanaticism consists of redoubling your effort when you have forgotten your aim. North Korea's nuclear test in response to the Bush administration's vain quest for regime change suggests that fanaticism is alive and well in both Pyongyang and in Washington. Now, North Korea says its aim is to trade in its weapons in return for getting the United States to end enmity. Now, that would enhance its security and open the flow of aid and investment from abroad to reform and revive its flagging economy. Yet the nuclear test, I think you all understand, only strengthen the conviction of those who believe that it will never give up its arms and that reconciliation is futile. The United States says its aim is to get North Korea to dismantle its nuclear and missile programs. Yet repeated attempts to pressure Pyongyang by threatening it with political isolation and economic sanctions have only led it to accelerate arming. Now, to hardliners in the Bush administration, Pyongyang's response is proof that it is determined to arm and should be punished for brazenly breaking its commitments. But far from it, Pyongyang has been playing tit for tat, cooperating whenever Washington cooperates and retaliating when Washington reneges in an effort to end enmity. Now, whenever the United States has moved to accommodate it, North Korea has responded in kind. After the first President Bush announced the removal of all U.S. nuclear arms from Korea in September of 1991, Pyongyang signed a denuclearization accord with Seoul and a safeguards agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency. But much more important, it backed up those words with deeds. To make nuclear arms, North Korea would have had to shut down its reactor, remove the spent fuel, and reprocess it to extract plutonium to make bombs. Yet, in a step later verified by the international inspectors, including Americans, it stopped reprocessing in 1991 and did not resume until 2003, thereby denying itself at least 50 bombs worth of plutonium over those 12 years. North Korea also showed some self-restraint on missiles. To make missiles that work, it is essential to test them. Yet the North has conducted just 3 sets of tests of medium and longer range missiles in 15 years. Those are facts, not hypotheses. Now, by contrast, when Washington did not engage in diplomatic give and take or failed to fulfill its commitments, Pyongyang retaliated, and I think you're all familiar with that. The nuclear test, by the way, is just the latest example. Last summer, under a year ago, under pressure from South Korea and Japan, the administration finally relented and authorized sustained discussions with North Korea in the 4th round of 6-party talks in August and September of last year. Washington grudgingly accepted a joint statement that incorporates the main goal it sought, which is a strategic decision by Pyongyang to abandon, and I quote, all nuclear weapons and existing nuclear programs. The September 19 joint statement also commits the North to implement the 1992 joint declaration of the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, which specifically prohibits, and I quote, enrichment facilities. Now, does Pyongyang mean what it says? Nobody knows. Lots of people talk about it, but nobody knows, with the possible exception of Kim Jong-il. The surest way to find out is sustained diplomatic give and take to implement that accord. It will take a lot of time, a lot of incentives by Washington, not by others, by Washington. It's very nice that Seoul and Tokyo are willing to provide certain incentives under certain conditions. But Pyongyang wants to see Washington move because it's enmity with Washington that's the key here. Now, when and if 6-party talks resume, the most to expect from the two sides is a first step to implement the September 19 joint statement. A comprehensive deal is simply not negotiable because neither Washington nor Pyongyang trusts the other enough to put all its bargaining chips on the table or expose its bottom line. The most urgent step is to restore inspectors' control over the plutonium reprocessed since 1994 and to shut down the reactor and reprocessing plant at Yongbyon. That reactor is currently operating, and it has about a bomb or two's worth in the spent fuel. Now, the North has offered to freeze its reactor and reprocessing plant, and it even offered to return the post-1994 batch of plutonium to inspection. But the Bush administration, as you know, has refused to settle for a freeze, and hardliners are blocking the U.S. reciprocity needed to get anything more than a freeze. What might be called freeze plus, some token step toward elimination by perhaps turning over a little of the post-1994 plutonium to a third party, or by sitting down with the International Atomic Energy Agency to discuss the concrete steps needed for elimination. It's a complicated process, and the IAEA will have to supervise it. Now, that would require Washington to resume heavy oil shipments and to provide some electricity itself. Seoul's not good enough. I'm sorry. That's not on. And take other phased reciprocal steps to reconcile with Pyongyang, end enmity, as Pyongyang eliminates its nuclear programs. That is precisely what the hardliners in the Bush administration refused to do. When China first circulated the draft of what would become the joint statement, that was done before the February 2004 round of 6-party talks. It was rejected by Vice President Dick Cheney. "We don't negotiate with evil," he told a meeting of top officials. "We defeat it." Now, the ink was hardly dry on the September 19th joint statement when hardliners struck back, reneging on the deal, every single commitment by the United States we reneged on within a month and a half of the September 19th agreement, and hamstringing U.S. diplomats. I'm happy to go through that if you want me to. I'll leave that for the question period. They block diplomatic give and take at every turn. A year ago, when Chris Hill wanted to jumpstart talks on implementing the joint statement, he was kept from going to Pyongyang unless the North shut down its Yongbyon reactor unilaterally, which I can guarantee you was why no talks ever took place. You will not get them to do something for nothing, ever. Forget it. It's not on. Now, when Pyongyang proposed on March 7 that a temporary U.S. DPRK mechanism be set up to resolve the money laundering, counterfeiting, and banking sanctions issue, Hill was instructed not to pursue the idea. Hill was also kept from direct talks with the North's Kim Gae-gwan in Tokyo on April 11th and 12th. Afterward, Kim Gae-gwan was blunt. "Now we know what the U.S. position is," he said. "There is nothing wrong with delaying the resumption of six-party talks. In the meantime, we can make more deterrence." Close quotes. That was in April of last year. Now, in addition to threatening more reprocessing and a missile test, Pyongyang reached out to Tokyo. But instead of resuming negotiations, Koizumi introduced a bill in the Diet on April 28th to implement economic sanctions that had already been authorized by the Diet. Within days, Pyongyang began preparations for missile tests. We saw that with our satellites. It conducted, as you know, tests of seven missiles, including the Taepodong 2, on July 5th. Yes, of course, they knew what day it was in Washington, July 4th. Now, in response, the United States got a resolution through the UN with Chinese support to condemn the North. No sooner did that happen than the North, again, retaliated with what you all know about, the nuclear weapons test. Do you want to keep playing this game? I guarantee you they've got a whole list of things they can do. Now, when we pressed for a sanctions resolution, I mean, undoubtedly, having said we're going to respond, the Security Council had little choice than to oppose some sanctions. But now the administration is pursuing a two-track approach. And I agree with Don that one side of it is hopeful. On one track, it did what it needed to do to resume six-party talks. At an October 31st meeting in Beijing hosted by China, Hill negotiated bilaterally with his North Korean counterpart, Kim Gae-gwan. Afterwards, he said the following. This is Hill. "They made very clear these were not conditions, but they wanted to hear that we would address the issue of the financial measures in the context of the talks. And I said we would be prepared to create a mechanism or working group and to address these financial issues." Also, the president spoke recently of a peace treaty. That's down the road, but it was another way to signal to the North, come back to the table, because as you know, they haven't quite committed to come back to the table yet. Now, but on the other hand, the very same day that Hill spoke, October 31st, President Bush put the emphasis on a second track, lining up a coalition of the willing to enforce the sanctions by imposing a naval and air blockade on North Korea, starting with nuclear, biological, chemical arms, and missiles, or what the administration calls the Proliferation Security Initiative. The president said, and I quote, "We'll be sending teams to the region to work with our partners to make sure that the current UN Security Council resolution is enforced, but also to make sure that the talks are effective. By that he means we're going to put pressure on the North. You put pressure on the North, I guarantee you, they will put pressure on you. Sanctions are unlikely to bring about policy change or regime change in Pyongyang. Pyongyang is not about to collapse, nor will it stop arming without quid pro quos from Washington. Instead, given its penchant for playing tit for tat, retaliation is more likely. The North can shut down its Yongbyon reactor, unload the bomb or two's worth of spent fuel, and reprocess it to extract the plutonium. In reaction to comprehensive sanctions imposed by Japan, it could also test more missiles, possibly a new intermediate-range ballistic missile, which we haven't seen yet. A nuclear test seems less likely for now. Those were their words, for now. The North, after all, has to fix what went wrong with the first test. But if sanctions won't yield much benefit, they do carry serious risks. The risks lie not so much in the sanctions themselves, but in a naval blockade to enforce them. Pyongyang has called that sanctions resolution a declaration of war. Under international law, that's precisely what it is. Indeed, at least four times in our history, the United States has regarded violations of the freedom of the seas as grounds for war. British impressment of U.S. sailors was the reason for the War of 1812. The firing on relief ships bound for Fort Sumter was the first shot of the Civil War. Remember the Maine? I'm sure you do. That was the Spanish-American War. And the sinking of the Lusitania helped lead the United States to side with Britain in World War I. So we are playing with fire here, and we ought to know it from our own history. Now, PSI has had no success in impeding weapons shipments so far, though I think you'll remember that a freighter bound with missiles for Yemen, with missiles on board, was boarded by Spain at our instigation in 2002, when the Yemenis correctly claimed it was a lawful transfer. North Korea was entitled to sell missiles, and Yemen was allowed to buy them. The ship and its cargo were released. Has there ever been a successful U.S. interdiction of missile shipments? Yes. In the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. Do you want to go there? That showed how risky a blockade could be. It also showed that coercion alone did not succeed. It took diplomatic give and take to get the missiles removed. The blockade actually failed in one significant point. The Soviets actually shipped nuclear weapons into Cuba, and we never found out until about 5 years ago. Now, two things about the Cuban Missile Blockade, and I'm going to end here. If you go to blockade, Congress and our allies ought to know what the intelligence basis of stopping any ship is. What do we think is on board that ship? And do we think it is armed? Secondly, we need to have clear rules of engagement in advance, and that too should be shared with Congress. Under what circumstances can boarding parties use their weapons? Can ships or submarines fire across the bow of a North Korean vessel, disable its rudder, sink it, attack submarines, North Korean submarines that might be patrolling nearby? Now, the Cuban Missile Crisis was designed to pressure the Soviets to reverse course and stop shipping missiles to Cuba. But what about the missiles already there? To deal with them, President Kennedy threatened escalation to nuclear war. But he also knew coercion alone would not work without giving Khrushchev a face-saving way out. So he had his brother, in secret, make a deal with the Soviets, which he denied until his death that he'd even made this deal, pledging not to invade Cuba and removing U.S. missiles based in Turkey. Will President Bush give Kim Jong-il and himself a face-saving way out? He could start by having China unfreeze the proceeds of North Korea's legitimate trade in the Bank of Macau and negotiating in earnest for a change, or else by sending a high-level emissary to Pyongyang, as Richard Lugar and other prominent Republicans have been urging. Administration hardliners are crowing that they finally have Pyongyang where they want it. But when President Bush took office, the North had stopped testing longer-range missiles, had one or two bombs worth of plutonium, and was verifiably not making more. After 6 years of fanaticism on both sides, it has 8 to 9 bombs worth of plutonium, has resumed testing missiles, and has little reason to restrain itself for more nuclear testing, or worse, reprocessing more plutonium. Is that where the hardliners want North Korea to be? Thank you.
Thank you, Lee.
The opinions expressed in this forum do not necessarily reflect those of the Korea Society.
The proceeding was a production of the Korea Society. For more information on our programs, please visit www.koreasociety.org.